I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Professor of History at Harvard University, Neil Ferguson. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. And now, join Bob Field on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Neil Ferguson and Roy Eisenhart.
Neil Ferguson is Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University. He's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute, Stanford University. Now, I'm going to go off script for a second because Professor Ferguson just informed us that at the end of this school year, he will be leaving Boston and moving to the Bay Area to work full-time at the Hoover Institute at Stanford. So you heard it first. He has written a number of award-winning books on finance and economics, politics and history, including the bestseller The Great Degeneration, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die, The Cash Nexus, Money and Power in the Modern World, 1700 to 2000, Civilization, The West and the Rest, The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, and The War of World, 20th Century Conflict and Descent of the West. I could go on. There are so many outstanding books. In addition, he has written and presented five major television series, including The Ascent of Money, which won the 2009 International Emmy Award for Best Documentary, a weekly columnist for Newsweek, and a contributing editor for Bloomberg TV. Professor Ferguson divides time between the U.S. and the U.K. He is here this evening to discuss his first volume of the definitive biography of Henry Kissinger, Kissinger 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. Of note, it was reviewed this past Sunday in the New York Times book review. So if you haven't seen it, I would encourage you to read that book review. Appearing in conversation with Professor Ferguson is Roy Eisenhart, retired attorney and former executive director of the California Academy of Sciences and a longstanding interviewer in San Francisco. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Neil Ferguson and Roy Eisenhart.
Well, welcome to Stanford.
Very excited about this move, I must say.
Better football team.
I wouldn't like to comment on that. I've got to be very careful what I say. I don't want to upset my current employer.
No, I understand. We are here, of course, tonight to talk principally about your most recent book, dealing really with the first half of Henry Kissinger's life. I want to make that clear because it is incredibly detailed and structurally interesting book. And what differentiates it from its predecessors, and I will use the term as a term of art and let you expand on it, it is an authorized biography. So I wonder if we could start really with the story of how you came to have this appointment and the honor to actually to write this book.
Well, I have to be doubly careful what I say with Henry Kissinger's younger brother in the audience. But I'll tell the story, which I also tell in the preface to the book, as succinctly as I can. I met Henry Kissinger more than 10 years ago in London, and we had a genial conversation. The way to get on the right side of an academic is to show that you've read one of his books. And Dr. Kissinger well understood that, so he showed interest in one of my books, and I was naturally immediately very favorably impressed by him. And then L. Macpherson walked into the room, and I was discarded with astonishing speed. Shortly after that, we exchanged correspondence, and then the idea came up that that I might write a biography. And I have to admit that after agonizing about this for some time, I said no. Mm-hmm. I said no because it seemed such a hugely daunting task. Daunting not only in terms of the sheer volume of material that I knew would be there. After all, this was a time that documented everything.
Right.
Particularly the 1970s, even the phone calls. But I was also somewhat daunted by the thought of Christopher Hitchens reviewing the book one day. Sadly, and I do mean sadly, that can't happen because Christopher, since in the intervening period, passed away. But I said no. And then I got a wonderful letter, which was really an introduction into Kissingerian diplomacy. Yeah. And the letter said, "What a great shame. Just as I've made up my mind that you're the perfect man for the job, and just as I find 100 boxes of letters and diaries that I thought I had mislaid, and I fell for this completely, and went, and within days, really, I was sitting reading through this material at his house in Connecticut, and within a very short period of time, once I had started to read some of the letters and diaries, I knew I really had to do it." Mm-hmm. But the word authorized, Roy, is important here because it's a word that some people misinterpret, and I'm not even sure I like it. The key to this book is that I was given access to Henry Kissinger's private papers, including some remarkably revealing personal documents and letters. But they're not the only documents used in the book. I also scoured the world for other relevant material. In this volume, there are about 50 archives. In the next volume, it's more like 110. Mm-hmm. And I said to him from the outset, "I'm willing to do this, but I have to have a completely free hand. You can't have any editorial control over it," which was exactly what I had said some years back when I had been invited to write the history of the Rothschild family. And so on the basis that I would strive to write the history as it really was, as far as I could establish it, and he would accept what I found on that basis, we went ahead. Mm-hmm. So it's authorized in the sense that I had access to him and to those papers, but it is not something that he had the final say on, and I think that's an important thing to emphasize.
Because the risk of the term, obviously, is this just becomes a hagiography.
Right. And it's not. I mean, I know it's not because he was incredibly cross with me after he saw the final version, and for at least 4 weeks there was complete radio silence, and I thought, that's it. Another biographer, Walter Isaacson, who's doubtless spoken in events like this, said to me with certainty, at the end of this, there will be an irrevocable breach between you at best. And I'm happy that that's not the case. And I'm happy that ultimately he's overcome the things that he doesn't like about it. Because I think this is such an extraordinary story.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story. And it's this first half of his life is so completely neglected in almost all previous books. Even Walter's excellent biography gives it pretty short shrift. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write a life that was not completely skewed towards the Nixon administration, which really most things that have been written about him are.
Right, and in a way, the book, I've read it, I must say, I read it twice, and I don't think I've yet assimilated the book. It is so rich in detail and in narrative. Barbara Tuchman would be very proud of you, I think.
Take that as a great compliment.
Yeah. But the wonderful part of it is that the book ends just at about the time that our consciousness of Kissinger's major role in national security and foreign policy begins. So it is a real teaser for you to get volume two out there, because I can't wait to hear it. But we're here tonight to talk about volume one. And what I'd like to bring out, among other things, is the powerful narrative quality that your book has, and I'd like to start with the description of his experience in the Second World War.
This is a hugely important part of his life, formative, as indeed it was for his brother Walter. And he and I discussed this in a very illuminating way when I interviewed him. You've got to put yourself in the position of a man, a young man, aged 22, finding himself back in Germany, having left it just 6 years before. 1938, the Kissingers are forced into exile by the Nazi regime, and they escape in the nick of time, really, to the United States. 1944, Henry Kissinger is in a U.S. Army uniform just in front of the Siegfried Line, having crossed into Germany just months after D-Day. And this is just a searing experience in so many ways. I was extremely fortunate in being able finally to persuade Henry Kissinger to give me the letters that he had written home to his parents at that time. And they're some of the most extraordinary documents I have ever come across in my time as an historian. As he writes in late 1944 back, he describes what it feels like to be back in Germany and to find Germany devastated. And he says, this is what they have brought on themselves. Now Germany knows war. He writes in another letter, now they know what it is to be driven from their homes. He experiences harrowing action, combat, under heavy shell fire during the Battle of the Bulge, when it seemed as if the German military might somehow be able to punch their way out of defeat. And then he has the most searing experience imaginable, which is to witness the liberation of a concentration camp, a place called Aalen, just outside Hanover. And this experience was searing in the most fundamental way. He wrote a brief account of this experience, which he titled, The Eternal Jew. And it consists of, really, him addressing one of the inmates of this camp, a young 16-year-old Pole, Folek Sama. It's such an astonishing document that I just quoted in full in the book. So that World War II was transformative, partly because it exposed Kissinger to war, but also because it revealed to him the horror of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And within a short space of time, when the war was over, he went back to Fürth, to his birthplace, to find that all the relatives that had stayed behind, including his grandmother and the friends, had gone, had been killed. So one has to, I think, one has to grapple with that. One has to begin with that to understand this man, because it's very hard for any of us. Certainly, it's very hard for me. I've led a remarkably easy, cushy life by comparison, to imagine what that experience must have been like.
It's interesting, because when you read Kissinger on that topic, he deflects it. He says, if what I've read is accurate, that he just says, oh, you know, that was an experience in my life, but it didn't influence me much beyond that, which to me came across as meaning it really was powerful, as you're describing, and he just doesn't want to discuss it.
My grandfather hardly ever talked about his experiences in the First World War. It's, I think, quite common for men who fought in the World Wars not to go on about them. And in that sense, I think it's normal and understandable that he didn't discuss it at great length for most of his adult life. And in fact, I think part of the reason for that in his case was that there was a lot of psychobabble written at the height of his fame, trying to interpret or explain him with reference to these events, and it was such nonsense, most of it, that I think he grew impatient of this rather lame and ill-informed psychoanalysis. Yeah. The difference here is that I've been able to go back to documents that he wrote at the time, letters home and these other essays that he wrote for his own, I think really for his own use, and therefore recapture what he felt at that time and what he was able to communicate. And these letters are remarkable. Brief anecdote, which gives you a sense of how this book came about and why it took so long. I knew for years that there were letters home from the 1940s because I had seen one. But I couldn't find the others. And I used to nag him about it. And I would say, I really want to see those other letters that you wrote to your parents. I think they'll be really important in telling the story of your early years, which of course aren't very well documented otherwise. It was only after I had finished the book that he gave me the file that contained those letters. And I remember thinking, I wonder how long I've got them for.
Yeah.
I had to read pretty fast.
Oh.
I think it was hard for him to let me have them because they were very revelatory, very personal.
Yeah.
Letters written by a young man going through enormously transformative experiences, written to his parents with incredible frankness. But I'm very glad that he did change his mind about keeping them back and let me read them, because in the end they make the early chapters absolutely come alive.
No, it's like the musical score. Those letters are like the musical score to that chapter. Yeah. You divide the book into five parts, and the first part is what we've just talked about. And it's interesting because the first chapter of the second part is called The Idealist. And I think it'd be interesting to develop that concept, because as people read this themselves, and particularly when you work into your second volume, the definition of that term is going to be very important. So would you go into that for us?
Well, I'm sure, Roy, that most people who see this book and see the subtitle, The Idealist, just think I'm being contrarian for the sake of it.
Right.
And I imagine that some readers of the New York Times probably feel quite cross when they see it. But I want to try to persuade you and your audience that this is, in fact, the very essence of the book. I had assumed that I was going to write the life of the arch-realist. Now, to clarify, for those of you who don't devote your energies to the study of international relations, there's a long-standing dichotomy in international relations theory and in the history of American foreign policy between idealism and realism. And putting it really crudely, the sort of Woodrow Wilson school that believes in international law and more recently human rights would be classified as idealist, and let's say Richard Nixon is conventionally seen as the arch exponent of realism, who puts the national interest first and is prepared to do pretty dirty deeds on its behalf. So this is the sort of standard distinction that's made, and historically people tend to think that realists read Machiavelli and admire Bismarck, and that's that's what they do. And idealists, when we think about this in a more colloquial way, are strumming their guitars and listening to John Lennon's early solo albums. So when I set out to write the book, I remember thinking what would be a good title, and I came up with American Machiavelli. That was how I was thinking about the book to begin with. And I think that even went on a book proposal that went to a publisher. Once I started reading these documents, within a really short space of time, I realized it was wrong. It was completely wrong.
You're listening to historian Neil Ferguson, whose latest book is Kissinger, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
In at least three ways, Henry Kissinger was an idealist. Number one, as someone who had lived through the consequences of the failed policy of appeasement, he regarded the appeasers as realists. There's a line in a lecture that I came across by him in which he says, the men of the 1930s thought of themselves as hard-headed realists. Somebody who had experienced the rise of Hitler and the disaster of World War II certainly didn't intend that as a compliment. Secondly, when he got to Harvard, he immersed himself, or was immersed by his mentor, Professor William Yandel Elliott, in the philosophy of Immanuel Kant. Mm-hmm. And I think incidentally, this was an attempt by Elliott to get rid of a pesky undergraduate who had turned up in his study saying, I am your tutee, I've been assigned as your tutee. I think most professors have had those moments. Busy, far too much to do, book due at the press, important meeting in Washington to get to. And Eliot, who was this somewhat bombastic southerner, said, go and read the works of Kant, thinking that'll get rid of him and I'll never see him again. But he did not reckon with Henry Kissinger, who proceeded to read the works of Kant and then write at the end of his undergraduate career the longest senior thesis in Harvard's history with the modest title, The Meaning of History. So, to be serious for a moment, this extraordinary thesis is a deep dive into Kant's philosophy and Kissinger's read of that, his interpretation of that philosophy. And the important point that he makes in it is that Kant is right. Freedom is real. It's something you experience when you make a choice. You are not merely the pawn of some great historical chess player. You are not on some conveyor belt through history that is going to lead the world to perpetual peace or some other nirvana. You know, freedom is real. And this was a very important insight for the young Kissinger. Right. He becomes very preoccupied with this reality of freedom as an experience, as something that you think, that you live. So I think in that sense, he's an idealist. And the third way in which he's an idealist is that he sets himself in clear opposition to materialist theories of history that were then so prevalent. Not only Marxism-Leninism, which is the great economic determinist theory that underpinned the Soviet Union, but also all the American capitalist versions that were popping up at that time that said, we can win the Cold War by having a better economic system.
Right.
Kissinger says really clearly at the end of his senior thesis, we should reject totalitarianism even if it turns out to be economically more efficient. We should reject it because the ideal of freedom is more important. To sum it up, it's a little abstract, but I think it's
absolutely
critical to realize that the Kissinger emerges from these early experiences and from his early studies as an authentic idealist in those three respects. And when he starts to be confronted with strategic problems, when he starts to think about foreign policy issues as a graduate student and then as a junior professor, it's very interesting that he tends to take the idealist side of most arguments. This ultimately leads him to a great spat with Hans Morgenthau, who was the arch realist of that time. And I think the fact that they quarrel over Vietnam is itself pretty telling. To begin with, Kissinger thinks it's another case of self-determination. The South Vietnamese don't want to be ruled by communists, and therefore the US should stick up for them as it had for South Korea. Over Germany, he takes a pretty standard Wilsonian position. If the Germans want to be unified, that's good, and we shouldn't prevent that unless it's reunification on Stalin's or on Khrushchev's terms. So I think the most important point this book makes is captured in that subtitle. Mm-hmm. This is not the Henry Kissinger you were told about. It really is a very, very different man from the man you were led to expect.
But it's one thing to sit in an academic environment and debate the spectrum of choices between evil morals, good morals, in-between moral choices. But then he moves into the position of being policy advisor. And I'm curious how his idealistic philosophy survived the need, for example, to go to Vietnam and have an opinion about whether that was worth winning or not. What happens to his idealism when he moves into the position of being political advisor?
This is an interesting evolution because it begins rather implausibly with an expert on the Congress of Vienna, which is what he wrote his dissertation about, being asked to write a book about nuclear strategy.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff happened in the 1950s. I suspect that today it would not. Kissinger had impressed enough his mentors at Harvard to get involved in debates about foreign policy. So Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was already a tenured faculty member in the history department, realized that his younger colleague in government was pretty smart, and so started to discuss political questions with him. So you get the first intimations of an interest in American politics, and particularly in American foreign policy. But his Harvard senior colleagues weren't so enamored of Kissinger that they immediately tenured him. Indeed, he was, by that time, had enough enemies for it to be tricky. So Eliot, who couldn't get him a job, Eliot tried to get him a job at MIT, at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and they said, he's an expert on the Congress of Vienna?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Because to most people in the early 50s, yeah, that just seemed completely irrelevant. Yeah. This was a brave new world of nuclear weapons. Surely history was all bunk, and one should simply study the future. Somehow Eliot persuaded the Council on Foreign Relations to give the man a chance. And he was given the job of pulling together one of these study groups that the CFR goes in for on nuclear strategy. And he went from pretty much zero to 100 miles an hour, learning very fast the ground rules of this new realm of strategy, and realizing that despite the technological change, it wasn't a totally different world from the world of Metternich and Kastelring and later of Bismarck. Mm-hmm. So the book Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy is published in 1957, and it makes him a star.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those books that propels somebody from the obscurity of academia onto TV. And as soon as he hits the television, maybe it's that distinctive accent of his.
Right.
Maybe it's just the clarity with which, yeah, he sets out the case. But he becomes influential in a way that really, I think, took his Harvard colleagues by surprise and comes to the attention of Nelson Rockefeller.
Mm.
And here's an odd couple. The playboy of the Western world, as rich as Croesus, with a chronic attention deficit disorder and dyslexia. A man who doesn't read books, he just hires the author. Rockefeller adds Kissinger to his collection of intellectuals, and Kissinger quite quickly establishes himself as Rockefeller's foreign policy advisor. So the first, I think, introduction to the wicked world of, yeah, of policy is advising Rockefeller.
Right.
And most of the time that doesn't pose a problem because Rockefeller himself is an idealist and is attracted by what Kissinger tells him, takes most of the speeches that Kissinger drafts, and is happy to deliver them. And this relationship lasts through three election cycles, three failed attempts by Nelson Rockefeller to become the Republican nominee for the presidency. I chronicle the ups and downs of the relationship, mostly downs, because Rockefeller never wins, partly to show that Kissinger can't really have been the devious and conniving plotter of previous accounts. Because if he had been devious and conniving, he would surely have realized much, much earlier that Rockefeller was never going to make it to the White House. But he sticks with him. And most people, by 1968, cannot understand, including William F. Buckley, who became a friend, why on earth he keeps backing this loser. But I think it's because ultimately they saw eye to eye on most issues.
That's a fourth reason why the term idealist might be defensible.
Well, sometimes idealism, we use it, I suppose, colloquially to describe a certain naivety.
Yeah.
I think when it came to U.S. domestic politics, he was an ingenue. He was the refugee who's really only been to a handful of states. There's a moment which is very memorable to me when he goes to the Republican National Convention in this city, San Francisco, in 1964.
Yeah.
And it's really his first glimpse of proper American conservatives. And it's absolutely terrifying. He cannot believe the Goldwaterites. He's so shocked by the experience, because they've got his number. I mean, they know he's a Rockefeller advisor. They can't bear Rockefeller. Right. Rockefeller's booed in some pretty... ghastly scenes at this convention. But they're also suspicious of Kissinger, let's face it, because he's the outsider. He's Jewish. And there's a moment when one of Goldwater's supporters says to him, "Ah, we know who you are. We know you." And this completely freezes his blood, as you can imagine. Because there's something really frightening about encountering that kind of prejudice in the United States, which you think of as your refuge from discrimination. There's a moment when he writes down a very shocking parallel. He says, this is fascism. There's a fascist element here. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is a really important part of the story. Yeah. Although Kissinger is somebody who quickly gets the hang of the debates on foreign policy and becomes a leading expert, even as still quite a young man, he is way behind when it comes to understanding how American domestic politics actually work.
Well, we all are.
I have to say I sympathize, because I never cease to be baffled by the weirdness and wonderfulness, to put it mildly, of American conservatism. It's odd, really. I'm regarded as conservative because in Britain that's what I am, and I'm a proud supporter of David Cameron and was a proud supporter of Margaret Thatcher. What do you prefer, Jeremy Corbyn? But here conservatism does mean something different, and I think that Kissinger thought of himself as a conservative even in his time as a graduate student, but in a very European sense of the word.
Yeah.
And he did not feel at all at home with the right of the Republican Party ever. And they gave him trouble, of course, later in the 1970s.
Well, I want to go back, not back to, but I want to continue the issue around the testing of idealism as a philosophy in a real-life setting.
Yeah.
And I'd like to mention when he goes to Vietnam in 1965 and his opinion that he delivers back to Johnson.
Almost the most exciting find, almost, was the diary of his first trip to Vietnam, because it really threw me to find that in 1965, when he went on what was effectively a fact-finding mission. He was there at the invitation of the ambassador, Henry Cabot Lodge, ambassador in Saigon, South Vietnam. But he went mainly, I think, to inform himself, because by this time it was clear that Vietnam was going to eat American foreign policy. In fact, eat American politics.
And it was also the year that Johnson instituted the draft.
Right. So, and escalated in ways that were extremely hard to reverse. I think 1965 sees really the worst decision in the history of American foreign policy, the decision to escalate. Mm-hmm. Kissinger had already had doubts about Vietnam, even under Kennedy, though. An interesting twist in the tale is that despite advising Rockefeller, when Kennedy offered him a job after the 1960 election, Kissinger jumped at it and worked in the Kennedy White House as a pretty minor player, but he was nevertheless in the Situation Room at least a couple of times and played a not trivial part in advising on the 1961 Berlin crisis. Not surprisingly, he knew a lot about it. He was completely out of the loop by the time it got to the Cuban Missile Crisis and was then back in Rockefeller's office. When Kennedy perhaps inadvertently okayed the coup in Saigon against the Diem government, Kissinger was shocked and condemned it and said, this is a terrible mistake, because from now on, if you broke it, you own it. We own the new government, and this is a really grave error. And he tried to persuade Rockefeller to condemn it. He really encouraged Rockefeller to be more skeptical about Vietnam, even in 63, 64. And Rockefeller's other advisors said, don't go there. So Kissinger goes in 65, realizing that the US has a problem. But when he gets there, he is appalled by just how bad the problem is. He doesn't just sit in Saigon. He travels around. He goes to areas that are basically controlled by the Viet Cong at night and by the US during the day. He meets with CIA guys. He meets with all the different elements of the US operation in Vietnam at that time. And he writes a report that's completely devastating, that basically says, this is not winnable on this basis. A, because we have at least five different agencies all pursuing different strategies. Mm-hmm. And B, because the Saigon government is, in fact, chronically corrupt. So as early as 1965, Henry Kissinger realizes that this war cannot be won absent a total change in the way that it's being waged, and begins to think about ways to extricate the United States diplomatically. Comes back, presents to his Harvard colleagues an argument essentially for a diplomatic end to the conflict. I was really, really stunned by this document. I'd known that his position had begun to change at that time, but to read this diary makes you realize, well, how quickly he got the problem.
Yeah.
I think it was because he'd been a counterintelligence agent himself. He'd been involved in countering Nazism in the late phase of World War II. He'd seen action. What he saw in Vietnam just horrified him. He said, I can't believe how the US Army has degenerated. Yeah. So I think that's an extremely interesting part of the book.
Yeah.
But it then leaves him with this huge problem. And the problem is, how on earth is the US going to get out of the mess that Lyndon Johnson and to some degree Kennedy have got it into? And that's when idealism starts to be insufficient,
that's
I think.
That's the point I was getting to.
So this is, I think, the most intriguing part of the book. He comes back and starts to think not about the obvious problems, not about the contemporary options. He starts to think about Bismarck. And he goes back to a project that he'd intended to continue, which was to write a three-part history of the 19th century, culminating in the First World War. Part two was supposed to be about Bismarck, the German chancellor who united Germany and ultimately created a new version of the German problem for his successors. I found in Kissinger's papers an unfinished and unpublished Bismarck book. And this was the most exciting thing. I'm a historian. I get excited about this kind of stuff. But here was the unpublished Kissinger book on Bismarck. And the fascinating thing is to work out why it was never published. He couldn't finish it. And it wasn't just because he was busy. He couldn't finish it because intellectually there was a problem. On the one hand, he did not approve of Bismarck's ruthless realism, the amorality, the way Bismarck regarded everything as a kind of struggle for survival. And yet, he could not help but admire the ingenuity with which Bismarck played the game of great politics. And it's at some point in the mid-60s that Kissinger starts to ask the question, do we need to do that kind of thing?
Right.
Do we need to be Bismarckian to get ourselves out of this mess in Vietnam? And that seems to me absolutely crucial to our right. to our story here, because it's the yeah. moment when the professor, the idealist, mm-hmm. starts to think about a really fundamental strategic problem that can only be solved
right.
using Bismarckian techniques.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features historian Neil Ferguson, whose latest book is Kissinger, 1923-1968, The Idealist. He's joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The problem that presented, which is a problem that we have today, is he was choosing between peace with honor, which was somehow a premise for whatever we would do in Vietnam, and the threat of the Chinese, how much do we accommodate the Russians, what are the domestic ramifications of this. So it seems to me that was, and the impression I got when I was reading the book is, this is the turning point, because he has to deal with not between a moral choice and an immoral choice, but probably the least worst yeah. immoral choice.
Right. Well, Kissinger had already appreciated in theory that most foreign policy choices are between evils.
Yeah,
I mean, he writes early on that it has to be a moral act to choose the lesser of two evils. It's still an evil, but you have no good choice. Very frequently, you can ask the incumbent president about this. he has a few choices between evils on his yeah. plate right now. The other thing that Kissinger understood was that in order to solve a strategic problem, you need to link different issues together.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think I've been able to show in this book is where the idea came from that would become the central strategic idea of the Nixon administration, namely to try to use the U.S.'s relationship with the Soviet Union and its relationship with the People's Republic of China to in some way improve the situation with respect to Vietnam.
Right.
The game plan ultimately became to open to China,
mm-hmm.
thereby to put pressure on the Soviets, not just to give in on issues of strategic arms limitation, but on other issues too, and thereby it was hoped to exert some pressure on Hanoi, on the North Vietnamese. Now, Volume 2 deals with how that strategy matured, how it was executed, yeah. and how it was only partially successful and in Vietnam not successful. But in this volume, I have to solve the puzzle of the genesis of this strategic framework, this notion that you could exploit the division between the Russians and the Chinese mm-hmm. to improve the right. situation of the United States. And it turns out, and this is truly remarkable, it turns out that this idea originated in Prague. It wasn't Richard Nixon's idea. It wasn't Henry Kissinger's idea. It was the idea of a Czech that you have never heard of, a man named Antonín Snáďarek. Both Kissinger and Nixon met this man in late 67, early 68. Kissinger had unusually good access to people in the Eastern Bloc, including in the Soviet Union, thanks to a thing called Pugwash, which some of you may have heard of, which was an academic forum that met annually to discuss issues of nuclear risk. And most of the people who attended it were scientists. But there were people like Kissinger who were there as political scientists. And at these Pugwash conferences, which he attended now and again, he would have meetings with his counterparts in Eastern Bloc countries. And one of the most amazing things that I came across doing the research was the conversation he has in Prague with this character, Snyderik, who's probably a Czech spy, probably also running some kind of semi-respectable international institute in Prague. And it's Snyderik who says to him, look, your opportunity, you, the United States, is to do a deal with Mao at the expense of the Soviets. The Soviets hate Mao, and he hates them. You think he's a crazy man. Remember, this is the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. But ultimately, he's a nationalist. And your opportunity, strategic opportunity, will be like the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact. It will completely transform the international balance of power because you will appear to be making a deal with the ideological arch enemy, with the ultra-radical communists of Beijing. Kissinger's immediate reaction when he hears this, and he writes this all down in a very careful memcon, a memorandum of the conversation to go back to Washington. All these sorts of meetings were carefully documented for the use of the State Department. His initial reaction is, you're mad. What a crazy idea. The U.S. get into bed with China? So initially, his response is one of skepticism. And I think it's fascinating to see that this was, in fact, the moment the seed was planted that ultimately grew into the opening to China and the 1972 Nixon visit to Beijing, which, more than any other event, really, changed our world geopolitically.
That's what I found so fascinating. You could see the roots of the whole the Chinese opening in this. I'd like to go forward just a few years because you talked about his affiliation with Rockefeller. Eventually, Nixon became the nominee running in 1968, and there's this well-embedded conventional wisdom regarding Kissinger's role in the peace negotiations that were occurring in October, just before the election, and your book rebuts the conventional wisdom, so here's your chance.
For those not steeped in the lore, let me briefly give you the conspiracy theory. That goes something like this. Kissinger found out confidential information about the Paris peace negotiations that had begun with the North Vietnamese by mid-1968. He leaked them to the Nixon campaign and was duly rewarded for his perfidy by being made National Security Advisor. Seymour Hersh, if you're in the audience, you might feel I've caricatured your argument, but that is basically how it goes. And it's certainly the way Christopher Hitchens tells it in the trial of Henry Kissinger. This is one of these stories that works journalistically, but not historically. It's not, in fact, plausible, nor can it be documented. It certainly can't be documented in anywhere that I can find. Almost all the evidence comes from interviews, and key testimony comes from somebody who had every reason to be hostile to Kissinger, namely Richard Allen, who had been Richard Nixon's national security advisor during the campaign and was right royally dumped when Kissinger got the job. So he's a pretty unreliable witness on these issues, at least so I contend. And Nixon's testimony itself in his memoir, RN, it seems to me, inadequate as evidence for this case. If you read it closely, Nixon reveals that there was somebody inside the 1968 negotiations giving them information, but it wasn't Kissinger. What Kissinger did was to offer his analysis just as he offered it to anybody who came to ask him. He did see himself as being nonpartisan as an expert. That's why he had been willing to go from Rockefeller to Kennedy in 1960. When it's clear that Rockefeller's out of the race, the Nixon camp approached him, and so does Hubert Humphrey. I mean, he was by this time in demand as one of the leading foreign policy experts. And it seems to me clear that Kissinger offers his analysis of the situation and talks to people in both campaigns. He didn't have any inside intelligence to give away because he wasn't in the loop. He had been in the loop in 1967 when he's involved in this abortive attempt to start talks with the North Vietnamese in Paris. But by 1968, he's not. What's going on in Paris involves other people. So I think this is a story. And it doesn't make sense anyway, even, you know, even if one leaves aside the fundamental problem that there's no documentation that quite stands it up. There was plenty, there were plenty of sources available to the Nixon campaign to tell them what was going on in Paris.
It was in the newspaper.
It was in the news. There were really no secrets about what was happening. And everybody knew that Johnson wanted to spring an October surprise. Because, apart from anything else, Johnson made it perfectly clear to everybody. So I think this story is one of these just-so stories. It's terribly appealing because it has a kind of simplicity to it. And it explains something quite puzzling, which is why Richard Nixon gives Henry Kissinger the job of National Security Advisor. Yeah. That is puzzling for a reason that you probably will be surprised to hear. Throughout the late 50s and the 1960s, Kissinger was regularly very rude about Richard Nixon, regularly said that he was unfit to be president, and avoided Richard Nixon, actually avoided meeting him. There's a moment in 1960 when Nixon writes and says, "I'd really like your thoughts on this question." And to avoid meeting him, Kissinger more or less invents a trip to Japan. You'll go, if you go to Japan to avoid meeting someone, you really want to avoid them.
Yeah.
So there's a puzzle which I try to solve in a different way, which is why on earth did Nixon make this offer? An offer so surprising that Kissinger himself didn't actually realize the first time they met that he was being offered the job. Kissinger assumed that Rockefeller would get a job in the Nixon administration at the Department of Defense, Secretary of Defense, and he, Kissinger, would work for Rockefeller. He was so sure that this was the plan that he wrote an elaborate memorandum describing how this would work, not realizing that Nixon had no intention of giving Rockefeller a job. He couldn't bear Rockefeller. He wanted Kissinger.
Yeah.
Guido Goldman gave me a great insight into this. He said, "The only thing of Nelson Rockefeller's that Richard Nixon could afford was Henry." There was a certain amount of malice, I think, that made it attractive to Nixon to take Rockefeller's most cherished advisor. On the other hand, Rockefeller was quite ready to encourage Kissinger to do the job, and as he had in 1960. So the final piece, I think, in the jigsaw is intellectual. And I argue that fundamentally, Richard Nixon, who was a misanthropic man who found it very difficult to meet people anyway,
and quite anti-Semitic,
who had prejudices at least as they came out in his, you know, casual beer-drinking conversation that would not have led you to expect him to want to work with Kissinger, nevertheless had come to admire Kissinger intellectually. When they first meet, when they finally meet, oddly it's Nixon who breaks the ice. And he breaks the ice by saying how much he had liked reading Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy. Remember I said the way to get on with an academic is to say how much you liked a book they wrote? Well, although he was not very socially skilled, Nixon knew that much. And I think he had read a lot that Kissinger had written in the interim. He'd written to congratulate him on an article that he'd written earlier about a Khrushchev summit, a Khrushchev visit to the U.S. So oddly enough, it turns out to be a kind of meeting of minds rather than anything else. And it turned out, I think, to be a correct insight of Nixon's that Kissinger and he were on the same wavelength when it came to strategy.
Yeah. There's one kind of wrap-up point that comes from a letter that Kissinger wrote, and I'd like you to comment on it, not just with regard to Kissinger, but with regard to events today. "The memory of states is the test of truth of their policy."
He puts the same idea slightly differently when he says that history is to states or nations what character is to people, to individuals. Kissinger's point, and I think it's terribly important, is that you cannot understand, say, the Russian president, if you do not know Russian history. And you cannot understand the Chinese president if you do not know Chinese history. Because history is what gives states their personality, their preferences, their prejudices. It's their sense of self-understanding. And this is, I think, one of the most crucial reasons why I wrote this book. I'm a historian. But I'm an applied historian. I think we should study the past in order to understand the present. I think we should try to learn lessons from the past. I'm old-fashioned that way. And one of the most important problems that the United States has been grappling with for many years, and certainly through two administrations in our time, is that key decision makers simply do not know history. They do not know the history of the countries that they are dealing with. Kissinger stands out in his generation as somebody who did not believe we could figure the world out with mathematical models, with social scientific theories. You need history, he says, to understand the way this world works. I believe that to be true. And one reason for writing this biography is to try to convince a new generation of American statesmen and American leaders that you need history.
Let me just wrap that point up, because when I read this, I feel like I'm reading the history of my life. Honestly, because there's so many events that you discuss and you describe, completely separate from Henry Kissinger, but I remember how I felt in 1965 and how I felt in 1967 and how we felt in the, during, well, it goes to the next volume, but when we get into Cambodia and so forth. And I'd say I recommend this book to anybody who wants to look back and try to put the events of their life into a rational order. Not that it makes them sensible, but at least the order is rational.
It is a life and times book, and what I've set out to do is, as far as possible, to get the context right. At each stage in this five-part story, you get the context, I hope, in a really vivid form, so that you kind of know what it felt like to be at Harvard as a recently demobilized GI, or you know what it felt like to walk into that crazy 1964 convention. Yeah. I've worked hard to do that, partly because I didn't live it. You know, I come at this subject with something that's either an advantage or a disadvantage, and that is I'm an outsider. I did not go through the trauma of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I view it as somebody not only of a different generation, but from a different country. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately, at least I hope, that that has been an advantage in turning it into history.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was historian Neil Ferguson, whose latest book is Kissinger, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. He was joined in conversation by Roy Eisenhart. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.